So anyway, this is the Taylor Report. We expect to be talking pretty soon, we hope, with Zafar Bengash. And we will be taking up this matter of the Gulf of, I keep calling it the Gulf. It's the Persian Gulf, and it is the Strait of Hormuz. And we, among the things I want to make sure we ask Zafar about is that this is, in a way, is a bit of an optical illusion. They're making us talk about the Gulf and the Strait. But there are other activities going on in the area that tell us there's something else afoot. I mean, and it isn't just to do with, oh, policing that Strait. Speaking of Strait, we're going to go straight to Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, hello, Phil. I am.
Hey, Zafar, thanks for joining us a little earlier than we had proposed, but we think this is a very important matter, and you're the gentleman who we believe has the most to tell us on this. This is Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. And I'll tell you, I'd like to lead off with where I was going with the, by way of introduction. We're having this moment at the Strait of Hormuz. Strait of Hormuz. I got it right this time. But there's a backdrop. I've been reading some additional things that have not been making headlines. That is that the Saudis held an Iranian vessel very recently for 11 weeks and wouldn't release it. There is also, I understand, a second vessel that was stopped and stopped for smuggling. And if I understand rightly, and I'm going to ask you to clarify all this, the Panamanian authorities say, yes, it was smuggling, and that Iran, of course, did the right thing. They stopped the smuggler. And then I don't know if this has been nailed down, but my understanding is that Brazil has not been refueling some Iranian ships. What all this means makes to me, it tells me there's a pattern of conduct going on in London and Washington that is telling its minions, its servants, to do some dirty deeds. Is that right?
Yes, of course. Let's begin with the Saudis taking the Iranian oil tanker. The Saudis had said that the oil tanker was experiencing some technical difficulties and problems, so it was taken to their port in Jeddah, where it was, and the Iranians said, yes, that is correct. And then after the repairs, the Saudis refused to release it, demanding exorbitant fees for every day that the tanker was there. I read the reports this morning that that particular tanker has now been released after negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Although they don't have diplomatic relations, but there are obviously some discussions that took place. With respect to the second oil tanker that you are referring to, RIA, which is a an Emirati oil tanker, that, as you rightly pointed out, today the Panamanians said that it was smuggling fuel, in fact, 1 million liters of fuel, gasoline, refined gasoline. And the reason why that was happening was that in Iran, the fuel is very cheap. They have kept it at a very, very low price. So obviously, 1 million liters would have earned a lot of money for the smugglers. And that particular tanker was impounded by the Iranians because it was smuggling Iranian fuel, refined fuel. And so that is the second tanker. Now, the third tanker, of course, was the British tanker, Stena Impero, and that's where the situation has become, very not only complicated, but quite dangerous. Now, let me share with your listeners exactly what this British tanker was guilty of. Number one, when it entered the Strait of Hormuz, it had turned off its GPS locator. Now, turning off the GPS locator is actually a violation of international maritime law. It's just like, somebody, for instance, driving on the street and they have their at night, and they have their headlights turned off. Mm-hmm. That was the first violation that this British tanker made. Secondly, this tanker, when it entered the Strait of Hormuz, instead of entering it at the entry point, it did it at the exit point. Now, again, if we look at the driving analogy, if instead of a person driving on the correct right-hand side, that person is driving on the left-hand side, and he has his headlights turned off at night, obviously there's going to be a collision with oncoming traffic from the other side. So that was the second violation that this particular tanker was guilty of. And the fact that this particular tanker had its GPS locator turned off, it actually had an accident with an Iranian fishing boat. Now, of course, when it was in collision with the fishing boat tried to contact the tanker. The tanker would not respond. So the Iranian fishing boat naturally had to contact the Iranian Coast Guard for, the shipping company guards on of the province of Hormuzgan, which is basically in the Strait of Hormuz, that is under their jurisdiction. So they sent out Revolutionary Guards boats to investigate what was going on. And when the Revolutionary Guards boats arrived, they discovered that this British tanker was also dumping oil residue into the Persian Gulf. In other words, it was polluting the Persian Gulf. It had its GPS locator turned off. It was entering on the wrong side of the Strait of Hormuz. And I think we need to keep in mind that the Strait of Hormuz is a very, very narrow waterway. At its narrowest, it's only 21 nautical miles. And, of course, that 21 nautical miles are shared half and half between Iran and Oman, the state of Oman. Now, it is important to keep in mind that at that point, it is not an international waterway, because Iran has 12 nautical miles jurisdiction and Oman has another 12 miles nautical jurisdiction, but only each country has only 10 and a half nautical miles jurisdiction. So there is not any area that is outside any country's jurisdiction. That means it is not international waterway. So any tanker or any vessel that enters there has to seek Iran's permission because it's on the Iranian side that it has the deepest depth and all of these tankers can navigate through. And so by turning their GPS locator and transponder off, they were obviously trying to evade detection. It entered through the wrong point. It had an accident with an Iranian fishing boat. And fourth, it was dumping pollutants into the sea. Mm. It was for these reasons that Iran took it in. And, of course, the British, as usual, took great offense. They called it an illegal act and a provocation, et cetera, et cetera. And they forgot that it was this tanker that was in violation of all maritime laws. Unlike the Iranian tanker that the British had illegally taken over on July the 4th, when the Iranian tanker was in international waters. And we talked about it, earlier on your program, that tanker, the British alleged, was taking 2 million barrels of oil to Syria. It wasn't. The Iranians said it wasn't, because Syria does not have a port that can take a tanker that is carrying 2 million barrels of oil. Syria simply does not have it. There's only one port, and that's the Bani As port. It is not equipped to take a 2 million barrels large tanker. And, of course, the British said, well, you let us know where it was going. And the Iranians said, we are not going to tell you where our tanker was going. That's none of your business.
Exactly.
But it was not going to Syria. And so that is the situation that we have. And, of course, the British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, who is desperately trying to win the nomination to become the next prime minister, but of course he won't. It's going to be Boris Johnson who is going to have that tomorrow, and then day after tomorrow, Johnson is going to be sworn in as prime minister. But the British have been
and acting. The British won't have a vote.
No, of course not.
They and get a new leader without a vote.
Yes, and the British, of course, have been acting on orders from the United States, in particular from this warmonger John Bolton, who is a paid agent of this terrorist group, Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. And so we have this mess in the region. But one thing is for sure, that what Iran has done is that it has asserted its own rights and sovereignty, and it has very clearly indicated that it will not allow anybody to violate either maritime laws or its airspace or territorial space, no matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this particular standoff at the present time.
Yes.
But I think there has been out of this, a positive development has also come that I just want to touch on, and that is that when the Iranians shot down that American drone on June the 20th, and the Americans, of course, were blowing hot and cold, and they were, you know, as they said, that Trump had mm-hmm. ordered an airstrike on Iran, and then he terminated it at the last minute, etc. As a consequence of America the Americans didn't want to, but I think they were not able to, because if they had done, there would have been very, very serious consequences for them. And this is what the American generals told Trump, that this has had a positive effect in another area, and that is that soon after that, the United Arab Emirates announced that it was withdrawing its forces from Yemen, and then they sent a delegation to Iran saying that, you know, we don't want to get involved in this conflict, and could you please tell the Houthis or the Ansarullah fighters in Yemen, we are not going to be involved in Yemen anymore, so please tell them not to target our cities.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Ansarullah have been targeting Saudi airports. They have hit a number of Saudi airports in southern Saudi Arabia. They have destroyed a number of their drone hangars, etc. They have shut down a number of Saudi airports in that region. And they have even been able to fire their missiles as far as Jeddah, which is hundreds of miles away. And so the Emiratis realized that if the Yemenis, the revolutionaries, were to fire even one or two missiles either at Abu Dhabi or Dubai, the whole place would be in total shambles. I mean, all they have is skyscrapers. And, you know, millions of people will flee the place, and that's mm-hmm. what the
if they're
Emiratis,
lucky, yes.
Exactly. And so, you know, the Emiratis basically depend on expatriates, foreign companies operating mm-hmm. over there. And so everybody would flee, those that managed to survive, and their mm-hmm. economy would collapse. So that is why they
yes.
sent their delegation to Iran, begging them to tell the Ansarullah fighters not to fire any missiles at their cities, because they are getting the hell out of Yemen. So that has
yes.
been a positive development.
A positive. And Zafar, on that theme, at that point, as the U.S. has turned up, ratcheted this up, and by the way, in a totally illegal way, this is extraterritorial authority which they do not legally possess. This has nothing to do with UN, any other international body, or certainly not international law, of a policy basically of strangulation of the Islamic Republic. There have been others falling away. When they told the story about the attack on the tankers, if you're going back ancient history about a month ago, there were states in the region ordinarily aligned with the West who didn't say a word and didn't agree, when kind of called on to say something. They didn't back up the claim that their vessels of theirs had been struck by Islamic Republic. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. In fact, they... Emirati foreign minister, while addressing a press conference with the Russian foreign minister, and the Emirati foreign minister was on a visit to Russia, he actually stated as such. He said that claims have been made that Iran was involved in attacking these tankers, but he said, as of now, we have absolutely no proof that Iran was involved. These were his exact words. And then he also said that if Iran had been involved, then the international community would have been able to provide some proof. And he said that we have not seen any proof so far. And so for now, our position is, and that was the position of the Emiratis, that we do not believe that Iran is involved in this. That is a very, very clear and categorical statement. And the only people that were sort of blowing hot and cold were the Saudis, of course, and the Saudis are absolute liars. They are conducting in a very, very bad manner. They even told the United States that if the U.S. were to attack Iran, that Saudi Arabia would pay for all the costs. Yeah. Now, naturally, the American generals have a lot more sense than accepting such silly advice from the Saudis. Who, incidentally,
but they've always been willing to do it. They did it. They supported Saddam's invasion of Iran, an eight-year war, and they paid for it.
Exactly, they paid tens of billions of dollars to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran and carry out that vicious war for 8 years. And then afterwards, in 1989, 1990, when the Americans came to attack Iraq, then the Saudis paid for that as well. In 1991, the war was actually launched in January of 1991, and that was because of Saddam Hussein.
It's like watching a group of criminal card sharks or something, because they also, one of the reasons that Saddam got into a squeeze and decided to go into Kuwait was that they all said to him, now that we've paid for your war, we want our money back.
Right. And also,
and he said, what money? By the way, I lost the war. But they said, well, we need our money. And
yes,
so the gang fell out with each other, as gangs will, and cut his throat.
Yes, of course. And there was another factor in that as well, that Kuwait was drilling in oil fields in a slanted manner, in the sense that, it was actually sucking oil from
Yes.
Iraqi oil fields. And, of course, Iraq was not pleased with that. And they told the Kuwaitis not to do that, but they thought that Kuwait would have the backing of Saudi Arabia and the United States, etc. And, of course, we now know that Iraq invaded Kuwait, took it over in a matter of a few hours. I mean, the Kuwaiti rulers were lucky to be able to, stuff their belongings, etc., in several jumbo jets, and with their multiple wives, they all fled to Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
So
lovely bunch of people.
Absolutely.
We're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and I'm really glad we are, because Zafar, we have to be concerned at how these things are reported, and there's a shorthand technique of reporting here that everybody seems comfortable with, but you just actually did a lot of damage to it. The Toronto Star today, it have about four paragraphs on the says British, I'm going to come to this, the British Navy tried to stop Iran. But the last paragraph, it says, Iranian officials say the seizure was justified given Britain's role in impounding. That's the only discussion of what Iran's point of view is. But what you describe is actually a designer provocation, because they turn off the transponder, they hit a vessel. They're going into a dangerous waterway from a wrong angle. So in other words, if we were to actually listen closely, and as you provided the details, we would know that this was all staged. So it's not Iran looking for a boat to grab. This is a boat looking to make trouble, and
exactly,
of course, running the risk of being grabbed.
Absolutely. I mean, if we can make a comparison, for instance, if there were a Russian or Chinese tanker going through the St. Lawrence Seaway. I mean, this is Canadian territory. And if that tanker were going at night and heading in the wrong direction, had its transponder turned off, and then it was dumping pollutants into the St. Lawrence Seaway, I don't think Canada would take kindly to it. I think that it doesn't require rocket science. Anybody should be able to understand that.
Well,
and that's exactly what this British tanker was doing in the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, very crowded seaway, because there is a lot of traffic. And there's one other point that I want to point out, that under international law, it says that Iran will allow only that traffic which is not hostile to Iran, which is friendly traffic. Mm-hmm. If there is ever any hostile traffic, Iran has full right under international law not to allow that traffic to pass through the Strait of Hormuz.
Which brings us to the British Navy warship. Why is it there? And it's another detail. Hasn't the Britain recently opened a new base in the Gulf?
Yes, the British have also opened a base in Bahrain, along with the American naval base in Bahrain. And of course, you know, the whole region is dotted with foreign military bases. I'm talking about the western shores of the Persian Gulf, whether it is Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, Kuwait, etc. Even Qatar, it has an air base for the Americans. So you have that whole western shore, and then you add the Saudis, who have just announced that 500,000 American troops plus aircrafts and armored personnel carriers are being shipped to Prince Sultan military base, which is just south of Riyadh. And of course, that was the base that was also used in the U.S. attack on Iraq twice.
And isn't this also a bone of contention, of course, amongst all Arabs, all Muslims, but also within Saudi Arabia? The whole story of bin Laden and his family, et cetera, there were people who said, you can't bring these Europeans and establish bases here.
That is correct.
Yeah, so it is a very contentious matter.
Absolutely. There is a fundamental Islamic principle, and that says that you cannot have outside military forces in the Arabian Peninsula. This was, in fact, the last order of the Prophet before he passed away, that there cannot be outside non-Muslim military forces in this region. This is a clear injunction. And the Saudis, of course, are in violation of that, and that is why so many Muslims, at least, of course, those that are familiar with their Islamic history, would take strong objection to these foreign military forces being there.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Zafar Benghash, Crescent International. And this about the warship, the British warship, you notice how quickly this turned into a propaganda game where we were hearing on our television and radio English voices, the British naval officer speaking to the Iranians, so that, you know, of course, the listeners here only understand English, and they already had this all figured out. He would communicate. That would be picked up by a British nominal NGO, I guess, type of entity, not a British state entity, but at any rate, one that tracks naval vessels. He speaks very carefully in the British formula for how to look at this. They said, don't tell us you're going to illegally enjoin this vessel from its traveling in international waters. I mean, it's like very carefully arranging to set up the use of violence or to force.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you can see the way they phrase this whole thing, you know, that you're going to be using force, you are indulging in illegal activity in international waters. All of these three are falsehoods, mm-hmm. complete falsehoods. Number one, this particular British tanker was going, it entered the Strait of Hormuz from the exit point, not from the entry point. That is the first illegality that a British tanker was involved in. Secondly, it had turned its transponder off. That's a second illegality. Third, it hit a fishing vessel over there, and then it didn't even respond to the fishing vessel's contacts or pleas, and it was also discharging pollutants into the water. And so on all four counts, Iran was perfectly within its legal rights to impound that ship and to take it to port, to Bandar Abbas, where the 23-member crew is being looked after. And they're going to deal with that matter according to standard maritime rules. and Iran is perfectly within its rights to do so.
And, by the way, they're perfectly within their rights to say, and who are you? This is part of an entity that is bringing illegal sanctions and impoverishing or attempting to impoverish and basically lay siege to a sovereign country, member of the United Nations. Who is this warship to be talking about anything, and what are they doing in that area?
Yes, exactly. You see, the thing is that there are so many illegalities that the U.S. and Britain are involved in, and yet their illegal acts are taken as if they are given. There is nothing abnormal about them, that they are within their rights.
It's normal if you're a pirate.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And they're trying to strangle Iran's economy. And when Iran acts in order to defend its rights, which are completely recognized under international law, and as you pointed out in your earlier, in your introduction at the beginning of this, that one of the tankers that was smuggling fuel from Iran illegally, and Iran, of course, impounded that ship, and the Panamanians withdrew their registry of that tanker. Virtually nobody is talking about it. Nobody is even mentioning the fact that there are a lot of illegal things happening over there, and Iran is trying to assert its rights under international law. Now, sanctions on Iran are completely illegal because sanctions under international law can only be imposed by the United Nations Security Council. Although, I'll be honest with you, I do not have much faith in the Security Council because it is also dominated by the United States and, of course, its allies Britain and France. And Russia and China gamely try to bring it back into some kind of legality. But very often it's the United States that gets away with all kinds of illegal acts through the Security Council.
Yes.
But even when it completely dominates the Security Council, none of these sanctions have been brought to the Security Council to be discussed or debated or voted upon. Mm-hmm. The United States has unilaterally imposed those sanctions on Iran. And under international law, they are illegal. Mm-hmm. And then not only does the U.S. say that, you know, we are imposing these sanctions, but other countries that violate our sanctions, we are going to sanction them as well. And so China rightly told them, go fly a kite. We are not going to accept your nonsense. This is just completely illegal. And China, of course, continues to import oil from Iran.
No, this is absolutely vital to understand. And there's another matter that we probably ought to touch on. This is a simple fact, is it not, that all this is traceable to, there was an outfit called British Petroleum, and there was an elected president in Iran, Mossadegh, and he and the people of Iran made the decision democratically and legally to take over British Petroleum. And so the UK, who is now butting in once again, and the United States, as they tell the world, they overthrew him and they put in power the Shah, a complete fraud, to run the country on their behalf. And the answer of the Iranian people became the Islamic Revolution. And that British Petroleum, UK, US, do not accept the Islamic Revolution.
That is correct. You see, it was in August of 1953 when an elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, decided that he was going to nationalize British Petroleum because it was stealing Iranian oil. And they were stealing literally billions of dollars out of Iran, and Iran was being impoverished. In fact, a barrel of oil was being purchased for something like 50 cents at the time. And this is the kind of ridiculous thing that they were doing. And, of course, the British and the Americans engineered a coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh. His government was overthrown. And the British and the Americans, of course, had hired goons, thugs. They went around beating up people.
Kermit Roosevelt was involved.
Yes, Kim Roosevelt was involved in that. And they basically hired criminal elements and they overthrew the government and brought the Shah back to power. And the Shah, of course, was their puppet. He unleashed a reign of terror for 25 years. The Americans set up the SAVAK, which was the secret service, which was notorious for torturing people. It murdered tens of thousands of people in Iran under torture. In fact, I can tell you, on one of my visits to Iran, I had visited the prison where SAVAK used to torture people, and I walked through the cells. These were horrible cells. Just walking through them, sort of, you know, one felt really, really sort of, you know, you felt extremely bad just walking and looking at those cells where people were kept and tortured and so on. It was just a very, very traumatic experience. And, of course, the people of Iran got fed up and they overthrew the Shah's regime and brought about through the Islamic Revolution and brought about through that revolution established an Islamic government. And this is what irks the British and the Americans, that they have lost the golden goose that they were ripping off for decades. And Iran naturally does not want to be their puppet. It wants to lead an independent existence, and it insists that it will decide its own future rather than be dictated to by the British or the Americans.
Yeah. And by the way, Jimmy Carter, President of the United States, everybody thinks of him as a lovely pacifist. You know, he was the nice president. He called the Shah a pillar of strength in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, he called him an island of stability in a sea
island
of turbulence.
Yes. He shortly fell off the island.
Yes, of course.
We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, and this has raised. There's also terminology I'd like you to discuss. I notice I'm listening to other programs or whatnot. People say, "Well, we have the moderates in the Islamic Republic, but they keep having difficulty because hardliners win these arguments because the conduct of the UK and the US has created hardliners." And again, it seems to me it's very sloppy language, because the people of Iran, they tell us at the moment, they understand the point. So we're talking about a point, a line, as the West would like to call it, where you say we're all together on this. And yet everybody, hardline, moderate, that isn't helpful language, is it?
No, not at all. I think these are totally artificial designations that Western media and Western politicians make. In Iran, people are united. In fact, their policies have united them even more. I mean, there is no doubt that in Iran, there are different opinions about how to approach various issues. And Iran is a very, very open and democratic society. There are all kinds of opinions that are discussed openly in their forums, on television, in parliament, outside parliament, in the newspapers. But when it comes to Iran's interests and the well-being of the people, everybody is united on that. There is absolutely no difference between them in any way.
And that's what caused the revolution itself. They were united.
Exactly.
It wasn't a question of, I like the hardliner. No, they knew what the question was. They said, call the question, let's vote. Throw the Shah out.
Exactly. And so they, you know, these people try to, in the West, these Western policymakers, they try to hoodwink their own people in whether they are in Canada, Britain, the United States, wherever, France. They try to create this fictitious image by presenting the moderates and the hardliners. They try to create that division by saying that, well, if it wasn't for the hardliners, we would be able to make a deal with Iran. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the people that they called the moderates, they made the deal with them, with President Rouhani and so on. They signed the agreement, and yet these are the very people that the West abandoned. So if you really think that they were the moderates, well, why did you abandon the deal that they signed with you, negotiated with you for three, 4 years? Everything was debated intensely, and all of these agreements were drawn up in front of the world, signed in front of the world, endorsed by the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, to say that this is now an international multilateral agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we know that in May of 2018, Donald Trump walked away from it.
Yes.
And of course, now we know through the courtesy of the ex-British ambassador to Washington, who said that Obama was upset with this agreement because, Trump was upset with this agreement because it was signed at the time when Obama was the president.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically what picked Trump.
So he lives only within the continental confines of the U.S. and is playing American games.
That is correct.
And he, so it's his, for his domestic power, he's willing to tear up international agreements,
exactly,
the kind that make it possible to have a peaceful world. The state that seems unstable seems to be, well, and I should make it multiple. France is ruled by a man who's hated apparently by people in the millions.
Yes.
Britain is now having to play a backdoor trick to change prime ministers without an election. And the U.S. has a extremely unstable gentleman about whom nobody seems to have an answer. And he's isolating his own country. And that brings us, the non-aligned countries are meeting. And Iran is featured there. Two-thirds of the world's countries are at that non-aligned meeting in, of all places, Venezuela, which, according to our foreign minister, doesn't have the president that is actually the president.
Exactly. See, so this is the thing, like, you know, the U.S., Canada, and a number of other countries tried desperately hard to overthrow through an illegal coup the elected, president of Venezuela, President Maduro and Nicolas Maduro, and they failed miserably. In fact, President Maduro has solid support in his country. And the fact that he has the support and the fact that he is in full control is vindicated by the fact that the non-aligned movement conference is taking place in Caracas right now. And so that shows that, you know, a country, a president, and a system that is in full control, only then would they be able to organize an international conference of that nature in which so many world leaders or foreign ministers are participating. So we see that all of these plots and schemes that the U.S. and its Canadian or European allies indulge in are finally unraveling. They're not succeeding. They're not able to carry out their plots as they used to do in the past, because the world has become much more aware of their machinations. Secondly, the world has become much more organized and determined to confront these imperialist powers, and they're no longer willing to take these destabilizing acts lying down.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are going into a new era. And I also want to add that Turkey, which is a NATO member, is proceeding with acquiring Russian S-400 missiles, much to the displeasure of the United States. And the Turkish government is saying that they're going ahead with it. They're not going to pay any attention to what the U.S. says. And it is their right to acquire these missiles. And in fact, they're even going to be going ahead with joint production of these missiles in Turkey. So
mm-hmm.
we see that there is a realignment in the world in which
yes.
countries like Russia, China, Turkey, Iran, Venezuela, etc., are going to play a much more significant role.
And they make their own agreements, and they simply walk through these artificial lines that have been set up. It's quite striking. And I have to ask you, and I'm abusing all your time, but we need to do this. The Prime Minister, or is he the President of Pakistan? Prime Minister,
yes.
Came to Washington.
Yes.
Now, there's a peculiar story. Today he met President Trump, but when he arrived, there was no one from the American government to meet him.
Yes.
There is footage of him getting off the plane, meeting friends, I guess, but no one from the U.S. government met him. And then he takes the ordinary transport, the kind that we all meet at airports. What's going on? He met today, and immediately Trump said, I'll work on the Kashmir issue for you. How do you feel about that?
Well, very good question. You see, at the present time...
This is cruel of me to bring this up.
No, ahead. That's okay. I'm glad you did. At the present time, Trump and the United States desperately need Pakistan's help. As Trump said in his press conference today, that, you know, we want to extricate ourselves from Afghanistan. These were his words. And he said that, and Pakistan is going to help us do that. And he's right, because previously, last year, he was blowing hot and cold against Pakistan and saying, we gave so many billions of dollars and they didn't do anything for us, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, immediately the Pakistani prime minister shot back and he said that Trump needs to brush up on his history. He doesn't realize that the money that he gave us was not bakhshish. It wasn't sort of charity. It was for services rendered. And then he itemized what sacrifices Pakistan had made. In the U.S. war on terror, Pakistan has lost 70,000 people. Pakistan's economy suffered $150 billion worth of losses as a result of American sort of, you know, tankers going through there and other activities, etc. And the money that the U.S. was giving to Pakistan was not charity. It was for using Pakistani air bases, using Pakistani roads, using Pakistani ports. Like, you know, nobody allows any other country to transport their goods for free. Mm-hmm. And so even now, the U.S. owes billions of dollars to Pakistan because it has held back that money for several years. And that money has not been provided to Pakistan, even though Pakistan had provided the services. But finally, the Americans realized that without Pakistan's help, they cannot get a peace treaty in Afghanistan with the Taliban, and they would not be able to extricate themselves from Afghanistan unless Pakistan wanted to help them with it. Yeah. And so having realized that, now they are inviting Imran Khan to come over, and we are willing to make a deal with you. We are willing to even help with the Kashmir dispute, yeah, et cetera. Well, if he does, that'd be great, but I doubt it very much.
Actually, wouldn't you kind of worry that anything he touched would actually probably be a net loss after he touched it?
Absolutely. It will go up in smoke, and I hope that, you know, he doesn't. Yeah. You're right.
But just a protocol issue. I'm very sensitive about leaders. Why didn't they meet him at the airport?
Well, I think they were probably trying to get even, because when Mike Pompeo had gone to Islamabad in September of last year, nobody came to receive him either.
Yeah, but he's the Secretary of State. He's not the leader.
Yes.
They can't even get protocol right. You're supposed to do, you're supposed to keep it at that level. In other words, okay, I would understand. Pakistan's foreign minister comes, they say, well, that's okay, he's here, he comes, he goes. Yeah. But this is the leader of the country.
Yes, and then if you want his help...
He's not the equivalent of Mr. Pompeo.
Although I must say that, you know, Imran Khan is a very, very modest person. He's not really, you know, too much hung up.
No, I was struck by his manner. He seemed to be, you know, impervious. He didn't care. He just...
Exactly. And also...
Very casual.
He insisted that when he comes to Washington, D.C., he's not going to stay in any expensive hotel. He wants to stay in the ambassador's residence in order to save Pakistan money, because Pakistan is really going through very difficult circumstances at the present time.
That's a very important point and to note. This is a different style leader. The Pakistan,
absolutely,
too, is going through some kind of transformation.
Yes, absolutely.
That you've been describing.
Yeah.
Well, Zafar Benghash, it's been very beneficial to our listeners. We appreciate talking to you, and we look forward to speaking to you again. We hope it's not about a war.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much, Phil, for the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we have a minute or two. Apparently we do, yes. And, well, that was very beneficial.
It was like a seminar, you know?
A seminar.
You got more information there than you can get out of the Globe and Mail or New York Times in 6 months.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. That was Phil Condon said that. Yeah. He's a classical underground Wednesday 6 to 8. And they know where they speak at that show. I think it's true. But you know what? It's the old, you must look at the details. When people start talking big picture, oh, they took our guy, we took his guy. I guess there's some moderates over there. There's some hardliners over here. throw all that in a wastebasket. You have to get right down to it. It's like if somebody says you're about to sign a contract. Read the fine print. Forget the big stuff. Read the little pieces there that for 3 years you will never do this. 10 years, you're out of luck.
Absolutely.
So the Taylor Report is a fine print program. So we have to thank Braden and Matty for coming, and I'll thank Phil Conlon, and this is Phil Taylor and Taylor Report. See you next week.